Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures, and we break them down into everyday terms for just regular people to understand. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by co-host retired Judge Gail Williams-Byers. In this episode, we explore President Donald Trump's executive orders curtailing diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, initiatives in government, the military, academia, and the private sector. We examine the concept of executive orders, chart some voluntary compliance, and delve into current and upcoming litigation. Judge Gail, this is a topic that is red hot. So let's start at the beginning with the whole idea of an executive order, because Donald Trump in his first couple weeks in office has issued just a slew of executive orders. I think we have four that touch on diversity, equity, and inclusion. But let's talk to our listeners first about what executive order is and what it isn't. You want to take that on?
Absolutely. And so first of all, I think what's primarily important for our audience to understand is that in this, you know, in a democracy, there are generally three separate co-equal branches of government. And so the term executive order initially or instantly refers to the executive branch, meaning
which is the president.
There are the other two branches of government being Congress and the judiciary, or the legislative branch and the judiciary. But this is an executive order coming from the executive branch, which is the third branch of government. If you think of a three-legged stool, it's one of the legs on the stool. And the order itself coming from the president is designed to delineate very specifically what actions are being ordered or instructed so that the oath of office, where the president commits to faithfully executing the laws of the United States, are followed. And so the executive order, given the power of the office, is designed to be an order under that power that orders others. And it could be, just as you said, it could be other government agencies. It could be anything that the government is connected to. So even if it's a, you know, school or university, as long as there is a government connection or federal government connection, then the executive order impacts it. Even if it's a private business, the executive order impacts it because the federal government has the authority, the lasting authority, to continue to control certain resources that it provides to whether public or private entities through these orders. And that's what this order is designed to do. The president issues an order and says, this is what I am ordering happen so that I am faithfully executing the laws of the United States. And just so that you all are aware, an executive order from a current president can be used to rescind or take back an order that may be completely opposite that was issued from a prior president. So executive orders also have what could be considered limited staying power. So it's these orders are temporary, and they can be temporary rather, and can only often survive the lifespan of the particular administration because a new administration can rescind them, can change them, can modify them, amend them, or completely override them.
Well, let me jump in here because I want to just add a couple of things and then get your take on them. First of all, executive orders are allowed, if anybody out there is a historian or wants to check up on us, they're allowed under Article 2 of the U.S. Constitution, and they've been used throughout history. But the key is they cannot override federal laws and statutes that exist. And that's the rub on some of those that President Trump has put forth and signed, is that they may, and some courts have already found some, do try to override federal laws and statutes, and that's not permitted. Also, you talked to Judge Gale about checks and balances. You know, Congress can enact a law that reverses an executive order. So Congress has some control there. And certainly the courts have the power, and I would argue the obligation, to find certain orders unlawful if they violate the Constitution or federal statute. So just because there's an executive order does not make it the law. Would you agree with that?
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. And I think that we've seen that with Congress pushing back and with some that have been directly affected or impacted or believe themselves to be directly affected or impacted by the executive orders, availing themselves to the judicial branch for action from the judicial branch in response to executive orders. So you're absolutely correct. So you know, what I neglected to say when I said that a president's executive order has the potential to only survive that particular administration, you are correct in saying, however, even in that, there are certain safeguards in place, such as Congress's ability to override it with laws or the judiciary's ability to respond to it by striking it down. And I think, you know, one of the, you know, without getting too far off topic, one of the examples that we've seen probably almost instantly is as it relates to the order related to birthright citizenship, where been the request to the judiciary directly, not even to Congress, to say, wait a minute, you know, we believe the court should affirm that this right still exists, notwithstanding the order.
Let's also be realistic. The Congress is dominated by Republicans in both houses. And so to get an act through Congress countermanding something that President Trump has ordered is next to impossible. So what we're relying on, even though there are two checks and balances in our law, we're really relying on the courts. Primarily,
in some regards, fingers crossed, right? We've certainly railed against the courts enough on this podcast, but we are fingers crossed, looking forward to or hoping, and really, really committed to this idea that that third leg of that stool, that judicial branch, is really going to be the cornerstone of all of this, and hopefully keep this democracy kind of patched together while we, you know, wade through these really interesting times.
Well, let's jump into DEI. And just as a historical footnote, President Abraham Lincoln used an executive order to put forth the Emancipation Proclamation. As far as racial equality, there's a long history back to the 1860s of the use of federal executive orders to promote racial equality. That was followed up by Lyndon Johnson, who issued executive orders to impose civil rights obligations on federal contractors to make sure that they were not discriminating based on race. So we've had a history of executive orders being used to advance racial and sexual equality. However, President Trump has issued three direct executive orders going back and wiping clean what President Johnson did back in the late 1960s, turning it on its head. And there really is a fourth executive order that relies on DEI as well. But let me just go through the four for our listeners before we jump in Gail. One is restoring the federal hiring process and restoring merit to government service. What a terrible title. That was issued day one by President Trump on January 20th. Then on January 21st, he issued the biggie, ending illegal discrimination and restoring merit-based opportunity. That was on January 21st. Then on January 22nd, Busy Beaver was President Trump. He issued another executive order, and this basically eliminated DEI in the military, abolishing all DEI offices and initiatives under the guise of restoring America's fighting force. And that was done on January 22nd. So January 20th, January 21st, January 22nd, and then he also came up with a one that we will not talk about today because it is far too complex. We'll get into that in a show on its own, and that was on January 29th. He issued an order ending radical indoctrination in K through 12 schooling, which has DEI as its core. Okay.
So no teaching Black history in Black History Month.
Yeah. No. Well, the government, the Defense Department's not even recognizing Black History Month, nor is it recognizing Martin Luther King Day anymore. And, you know, all of these, the timing couldn't be worse or better, depending on how you're looking at it. February being Black History Month, that all of this is going down. The first one that I want to talk about real briefly, the restoring federal hiring process and restoring merit to government service. I hate these titles because it's taking DEI and saying that it's immoral and it's really damaging to the government. And we need to restore merit to government service by installing white people into the process. That's what it's saying. But basically, it eliminates all DEI and federal hiring. That might not have legal problems. Would you agree with that? That one might stand.
I'll say it might. It may not, because I think we're talking about, you know, arguments as to the intent of it. There may be, you know, some, I like to call slip covering that we put on it to say that, you know, hey, there's a really race neutral intent, and the government does have an interest in some of these things that are race neutral. But I don't know that all of these orders, no matter where they're targeted, whether federal or private, I don't know that they will all be perfectly okay within the realm of the judiciary. I think that maybe some will, or some may be contoured to and amended so that they can, you know, satisfy the rule of law. But I quite frankly also think that many of these orders were written so vague and so sloppily, and that they have not been thoughtfully crafted, that they necessarily invite all of the litigation that they're getting, such that even the ones that we think should survive or may survive, they may not, and rightfully so.
Well, that's one, and the military one. Right now, there's no litigation on that, abolishing DEI in the military. Also, there have been actions against transgendered people in the military. Those right now are still standing.
They may be looking for parties that are willing to come forward to litigate
And venues. where lawsuits, especially on this federal level, plaintiffs who want to challenge something try to pick a venue or a court, a jurisdiction that might be more liberal or more at least not rock rib conservative. So you will see very few of these lawsuits filed in the South. On the birthright citizenship, for example, the successful lawsuits were filed in the state of Washington, the state of Maryland, and another one's filed in the state of Massachusetts. So, you know, people choose venues that they think might be at least more amenable to listening to their arguments. But that's a legal tactic that goes back from time immemorial, right?
Indeed. And I'll also add, you're absolutely right. We call that in our business, we call that forum shopping. And this is essentially a form of forum shopping. We actually saw it done pervasively with Judge Kaczmarek in Texas, such that the federal bar had to step in and to essentially bar Republicans from continuing to file cases in a court that they knew that they could pretty much predetermine the outcome. Now, our listeners might be wondering, well, wait a minute. How does this happen such that, you know, these judges are able to make these decisions and now everybody's got to abide by them? So I just want to put a little side note here for our listeners. Federal judges, unlike your state judges or your local judges, are vested with a considerable amount of power and authority. And although they sit in certain districts and in certain states and certain areas, the judgment or the ruling of a federal judge has the ability to impact the entire nation. And so,
well, let me jump in on that. The birthright citizenship case, there was a temporary restraining order, a 15-day order issued by the judge in the state of Washington. But just this past week, the judge in the case in the state of Maryland issued a preliminary injunction that she stated applied to the entire nation. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Indeed. I thank you for clarifying that. But I just want our listeners to understand that this is the power and authority of federal judges, the ability to issue orders that are not limited to the state that they're sitting in, not limited to the jurisdiction that they've been appointed to, but rather they have the ability to affect how entire schemes proceed nationwide, consistent with the example you gave about birthright citizenship. But that is not the same power and authority that's vested to your state and local judges, not even your state Supreme Courts. They can affect the state, but their reach is kind of limited. If you think about, you know, the, you know, Marvels or any other superhero and they have a force field, consider the state's boundaries or borders as kind of the force field or the limitation of your state Supreme Court and some of your state appellate courts. They are limited to the certain jurisdictions that they're in, and that's not the limitation of federal judges. Their reach is nationwide, kind of like how Congress works and how the executive branch works when they issue an executive order that affects us all nationwide.
So let me jump into the executive order that we want to talk most about. And that was the one issued on January 21st, ending out. Get this title again. I can't emphasize this enough. The title is Ending Illegal Discrimination and Restoring Merit-Based Opportunity. It sounds like, just from the title, that's going to advance the position of people of color. That's going to advance the position of women. That's going to advance the position of LGBTQ plus people. But it's exactly the opposite. It's exactly the opposite. So what
it's
that
almost
order,
like asking, did LBJ need like an extra executive order to like buttress what he did with civil rights? This is this it?
It's amazing. I want our listeners to really read these. It's way too long for us to go through line by line these three orders, but you can find all of these at www.whitehouse.gov. And look at presidential actions, and they've got every one of these verbatim. So again, www.whitehouse.gov, and look under presidential actions, and you can find all of these.
Start with the idea that this order calls diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, DEI programs, dangerous, demeaning, and immoral race and sex-based preferences. This is how it describes an effort that has long since been respected, appreciated, and appropriately applied, an effort to address what has been this nation's history of systematic racism, dating all the way back, even before slavery, if we think about how Native Americans were treated. But it responds to this by suggesting that there was no lasting impact on any of that. And instead, anything that's been put in place to respond to or correct it or address it is dangerous. Like it is dangerous to admit that we should not have enslaved people and been barbaric and treated them inhumanely, and that we should not have stolen land and thereby, you know, limited Native Americans to reservations and provided no opportunities for them, that it is dangerous and demeaning. I'm not sure to whom, but demeaning, I can only suspect to white males, but it's demeaning that we would actually address these and acknowledge the abhorrent wrongfulness of our historic actions.
And immoral to whom? To white Christian nationalists? I mean, how is it immoral to provide an equal playing field for all races, genders, and people of different sexual orientations? How is that immoral?
It's so interesting because, you know, as you know, I am the daughter of a Black Baptist preacher, so I could probably rattle off about 1,700 Bible verses that, you know, that completely support why we should be doing this. And this is what, this is why it baffles me that those who do these things under the banner of Christianity are essentially supporting what could be nothing, interpreted as nothing other than hypocrisy. This is absolute hypocrisy. And again,
it's bigotry on the foot. You know?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And let's discuss the fact that those who stand to benefit most and who will benefit from this are also those who deserve it the least. Because if you're talking about merit-based, you now are talking about, first of all, minorities who always had to work twice as hard to get half as far, but now you shift the preference
for half the money.
Fraction. Half is generous. I mean, you have some that are making a fraction of that, although they are exceptional individuals and have always only just needed an opportunity where they had not existed before. And yet, here we are now saying to, you know, non-minority males, that, you know what? No, what we celebrate is mediocrity. That's what our gold standard is mediocrity.
Before we got on the air, you talked about a quote from a congresswoman, and why don't you
oh my goodness,
paraphrase that, because I think it's perfect for
so
what
Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett is my new shero. In fact, someone told me this months ago that when they saw a clip of her on the House floor, or actually no, it was in a committee room, that she reminded them of me. And I said, I could only be so lucky. But essentially, you know, what she said without quoting her verbatim is essentially the repealing of DEI is a scheme that is set up to allow or provide for mediocre white men to continue to fail forward. And that is just It is like the nail on the head.
It's so perfect.
Absolutely perfect for this, because that's precisely what it at least appears to be. And no doubt, notwithstanding what it appears to be, that will be the effect. That will be the outcome. There is no other way around it. That will absolutely be the effect, because this administration apparently appears to be just very bent on ensuring that as the outcome, no matter how unprepared, unintelligent, and regardless of the limitation of these individuals. I could start naming off people who are, you know, in positions right now who've been nominated and cleared for cabinet positions that you just have to scratch your head and say, is that all it takes? Because I promise you, somebody who has like the resume of a Justice Ketanji Jackson that is very well accomplished, her resume, no matter how impressive it is, will be stacked up against someone whose resume can fit on a note card. And nonetheless, because she's a Black female, she would be overlooked and completely disregarded because she just lacks the proper autonomy or, you know, anatomy rather. And she also lacks the proper skin color.
Yeah, that's the part that's just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I think that we should do in talking about this, and it's hard because it's cumbersome, but we've allowed the Trump people to talk about DEI, DEI, DEI. They don't talk about the words, those words, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. How can that be, as they say, you know, dangerous, demeaning, immoral to have diversity, equity, and inclusion? Give me a break.
Well, no, actually what it does is it sends a very loud, resounding message, which is we don't celebrate that which is not like us. So we don't celebrate diversity. In fact, you know, whereas you and I believe that what makes us different makes us stronger, and we're benefited by having diverse, either diverse perspectives in the room or diverse backgrounds or
in conversations, in ideas, in history, in culture, all of those things.
Well, remember when critical race theory was the boogeyman that, you know, no one could ever define?
Oh, still is. in when we get to the K-12, still is.
Indeed. And so DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion, is now kind of the modern day boogeyman. And it's the boogeyman. And I think in large part because there just isn't a lot of understanding or appreciation for, just like you said, you break those three words down and you have to ask, well, gosh, who among us would really be against, you know, diversity in all of these different forms? Because diversity, although it, yes, can reference diversity in background and ethnicity, that is not the limitation of it. It speaks to
gender.
It speaks
sexual orientation, all kinds of things.
All kinds of things, but also, you know, diversity in thought, diversity in background, diversity in perspective. All of these things are now persona non grata because it is, you know, no thank you. If you talk about the term equity, my gosh, who would have ever thought that the term equity is now a bad word to use? Just really?
Equity. Making it an even playing field. Equity.
Yeah. Yes. Making it equal. It doesn't mean making it the same for everybody. It means that you are now equalizing the playing field so that now everyone can compete equally, especially in taking into consideration the limitations that you've placed on some people so that they couldn't even get off the starting blocks, much less compete. They could never leave the starting blocks. So yes, you have generations of folks who benefited from nothing other than just the accident of their birth. And that has provided them with great opportunity in a country that we say is the land of opportunity, but it has been an opportunity for some, but not all. I like to use this example, and you could tell me what you think. I like to use this example when explaining to folks about kind of the impact of systematic racism over hundreds of years, centuries. Imagine inheriting a company from your grandparents or your great-grandparents. And for the entire lifespan that that company has existed, it was built on the backs of employees that you never had to pay. You never paid not one wage to one employee ever. Your employees were forced to show up and work for you every day with no pay. And if they refused to show up and work for you, you could kill them, or you could sell them to someone else that perhaps they would work for them, but you would actually get paid for selling that employee to someone else so they could build then their company.
Because imagine never property.
Imagine never having to pay for sick leave, vacation, retirement, or any other benefit that any other employee might enjoy. Imagine having this happen and being able to essentially collect all the revenue from this company for hundreds of years. You, as the heir to this company, would be so much farther ahead than, oh, say, let's say the grandchild of one of those employees. That is a gross inequity that absolutely existed and still exists very day.
Yeah.
But imagine all the wealth you could amass if you were the heir to a company that had that kind of a head start.
But
to
take your forced employee and make that person have more equal opportunity to the business owner, it's the whole concept of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And, you know, it's just fundamentally right. But it's certainly not dangerous, demeaning, or immoral. It's maybe dangerous, demeaning, and immoral to the white landowner or business owner in your hypothetical, but to no one else, not to society.
The immoral part was how you came to inherit a business that had amassed so much wealth in that manner, right? Wouldn't that be the immoral part?
Right. Certainly not immoral to level that playing field. You know?
And to say, I recognize that how we did this was absolutely wrong. And if we really want to go back to that idea of Christianity and Christian, you know, faith and faith-based belief, then there has to be something about that entire experience that was centuries old and continues to have centuries worth of impact that should be telling you, you know what? No, we should be doing right by this. Yeah, we need to acknowledge it. We need to recognize it. We do need to correct it. And it is important that we not repeat this mistake. Here's, I think, what the strategy of some is, maybe not all. You know, there's a saying that I learned way back when I was in high school and on the mock trial team and just getting comfortable with presenting to juries. But someone told me, those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it. And if we can create an environment where we now create generations who don't know their history, who have no idea what happened, who are not invested and have no clue, then we set ourselves up for being able to repeat it. Why? Because nobody knows where we're going back to because we never taught them. This is, I think, why you have, you know, our Jewish brothers and sisters who's like, oh, there will never be another Holocaust. We will never again do this. But there are some, I believe, that are engaged in this behavior because the hope is that, hey, we can maybe dial the clock back. And if we can dial the clock back with people that are ignorant, they won't know the difference. And we can truly regain what we believe is our superior status. And I think this is a step toward that?
Well, in particular, this executive order, the one ending illegal discrimination and restoring merit-based opportunity, has the mandate for the Attorney General, Pam Bondi from Florida, former Attorney General there. She has 120 days to come forward with an enforcement plan. Now, get this. Attorney General has 120 days to submit an enforcement plan containing this. I've got the word right here. Containing for enforcing federal civil rights laws and taking other appropriate measures to encourage the private sector to end illegal discrimination and preferences, including DEI. Now, 120 days to come forward with a report of how she's going to do this. Enforcing federal civil rights laws? This does nothing to enforce federal civil rights
laws. It's the exact opposite.
It's exactly the opposite.
I look forward to hearing how this will be twisted and somehow rationalized.
It's exactly the opposite of what they're saying. You know, it's 120 days to have recommendations to all state and local education agencies that receive federal funds, as well as higher education that receive grants or participate in federal student loan programs. You know, this is the opposite of what the verbiage says it is.
And remember, I don't think this is even going to be limited to that. I think you're going to also see tentacles reach into state and federal government. I mean, to state and local government. And so you're going to have, I believe, some state and local governments that are now looking at, okay, well, gosh, you know, how do we make sure our police forces are diverse without this federal funding? They don't care if police forces are diverse. How do we make sure that our workforces are diverse? That's your problem. We just don't. And it is, this goes into, I think, some of the really important conversations that we've had before about how the citizenry trusts or doesn't its own government. And oftentimes that trust is born out of being able to see and relate to the very people that have been put in power and required to enforce these things. It's going to be really interesting, yes, how we see this develop in academia and in educational settings, but I think we are maybe fooling ourselves if we don't think that this is also going to rear its head in areas that we may not have originally contemplated, again, such as local government, such as statewide government, and even in the private sector, who, you know, some feel are, you know, pretty inoculated from this. But as you just read, the requirement to the Attorney General is going to be to take appropriate measures to encourage the private sector to end what they are already calling illegal discrimination. And I just think what this is setting the Department of Justice up for is this is going to be long, protracted litigation. And this is going to take us all the way back probably to the days of Abraham Lincoln's executive order with the Emancipation Proclamation and moving it forward and outlining why there was clear supportive reasoning for these orders then and why they are still necessary now.
And Judge Gale, the facts belie their premise. You know, I did some research on some surveys of Fortune 500 companies. Only 10.4% of CEOs are women, and only 1.6% are Black Americans. Now, how are they getting an advantage?
When they're so poorly represented?
When they're so poorly represented.
I don't know why white women are not more up in arms.
Pew study in Pew Research in 2023 said 60% 8% of Americans believe being white helped someone get ahead, and 42% thought it helped them a whole lot in getting ahead.
So
regardless of their competence.
Back to my example of inheriting that company without regard to skill set, know-how, ability. But yes, this is exactly the thing. It is the number one, I believe, the number one characteristic that almost determines success or failure.
So we mentioned that the executive order does not target private companies.
But yet.
It does have a major impact on recipients of government funding. And you think, as you mentioned, states are recipients of government funding. Municipalities and local areas are recipients of government funding. Healthcare research recipients of government funding. Universities in the form of Pell Grants and student loans, in addition to the research funded by the NIH and other federal agencies, that federal dollars come to universities to advance research on various causes. That's a major impact, but then they want to take it a step further and say, hey, we can't really do anything right now to private companies, but look at the trend and jump on board.
Can I say something really quickly?
Sure.
And you're right,
absolutely,
there is a trend. But I was reading, I think yesterday or the day before, that you had companies like Google, which is massive, huge. But Google has responded affirmatively to the administration's executive order because of its position as a government contractor. And and notwithstanding the amount of wealth this company has and has amassed and stands to maintain, even if it weren't a government contractor, it's nonetheless bent to the will of this because of its stance as a government contractor, that, which I think is just kind of, it's really, really unfortunate. And the reason it is so unfortunate is because, let's assume arguendo, Google says, you know what? Yeah, we know we're a government contractor, but if abandoning our deeply held beliefs that this is nonetheless the right thing to do and this is what we should be doing, if that means we have to give up this government contract, then so be it. We already got enough money. We don't need more money. And maybe it's not about the money, right? Maybe it's access to something else, or maybe it's there's some other ancillary benefit. But it really does call into question what the credo of these companies are when many of them in the private sector can just so easily walk away from what they've led the vast majority of us to believe are their deeply held beliefs. And it just, I think, shows that maybe the beliefs are not as deeply held as they purported. I'm not suggesting that they don't have any beliefs, but I'm saying that, you know, when after the murder of George Floyd, which was, you know, aired for all to see, a white police officer literally murder a Black man in front of all of us, there were hardly any major companies in this country that did not stand up and vocally express their support for the, you know, fair treatment of Blacks, the fair treatment of women, the fair treatment of individuals in the LGBTQIA community, you name it. I mean, I remember my email being flooded with all kinds of confirmations and statements and commitments to, you know, this is what we stand for. And even as horrific as the incident and the murder of George Floyd was, what is, I think, challenging right now is the idea that you have these same companies that can seemingly just as easily walk away from it as they did embrace it, which to me just kind of challenges my belief in their sincerity in the first place. I'd almost rather them never made a pronouncement.
Well, NPR, National Public Radio, just came out with a story this morning And we're recording this on Friday, the 7th of February, that these companies are eliminating language of DEI from all of their corporate publications. Disney, Google, GM, GE, Pepsi, Intel, PayPal, Chipotle, Comcast, 3M, Regeneron, Philip Morris. These companies have ended DEI programs. Walmart, Target, Amazon, Meta, Ford, McDonald's. You know, then we have the NFL eliminating end racism from their goal line markings. You know,
and, from the end zones. Yeah.
From the end zone.
And also probably on the back of the helmets. You might have noticed that it was on the back of the helmet.
Exactly. So they're doing that just because President Trump is coming to the Super Bowl. You know, we have what I perceive as being an overreaction from these companies. Total overreaction.
Or maybe it's just the show of the initial lack of sincerity in the first place. Maybe that's what it is.
Or both.
And, you know, I was so encouraged. I was amazingly encouraged when not long after the issuance of this executive order, the American Bar Association, which I think both of us are members of, I am a proud member of the American Bar Association. The president of the ABA actually released a statement doubling down on ABA's commitment to diversity, to inclusion, to ensuring that this profession is stocked with the best talent, but that we're also providing opportunities to individuals who otherwise would have been cut off from ever participating. And that's what enriches us. That's what makes us better. That's what makes us, you know, a wholesome and a force to be reckoned with and makes the legal profession honorable. I was so very proud to see the ABA respond the way that it do, especially in the wake of all of these other organizations just kind of saying, well, you know what? That's just one line item. We can strike out the budget. It is not about a line item in your budget. It is about a commitment to something fundamental that should be core to, again, your credo, your ethos, who you are. And if it is so easy to walk away from it, it just makes you kind of wonder how sincere you ever were in the first place.
I'll tell you, let's talk a little bit about universities right now, because their targets with, as I said, federal scholarships and loans and research dollars, universities across the country are getting ready to eliminate DEI offices, race, anything to do with race, gender, women.
So no more women's studies?
No more women's studies, no more African-American studies, no more special groups for LGBTQI people. West Point just disbanded all of their clubs for women and minorities. We're seeing universities. University of Iowa eliminated all of their DEI. All of the other universities look like they're almost ready to do that. The University of Akron in your home state, my former home state of Ohio, will not hold its annual Rethinking Race Forum, which has sought to engage the community with topics related to social justice, diversity, equity, and inclusion. The forum started in 1997 and has been held each year during Black History Month. That has been eliminated this year. You know, we're having all of these reactions, and, you know, I'm waiting. We do have some litigation that I want to get to in a moment, but I'm waiting for these groups, these corporations, somebody to just stand up and say, back the F off,
you know? Right?
Just back off. We're not doing this, you know? We're not doing it. You
well,
know,
I don't
this
think
is
free
wrong.
Thinking like that is really invited in this environment. But I do believe, based on what we've seen, and we've kind of seen it, you know, just about every step of the way, that there are certainly, you know, those who are willing to take all of this to task. I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of litigation kind of pent up in a lot of places that just says, hey, listen, you know, it's okay. And we're okay with this, you know, administration kind of having a goal or direction it wants to go in. Every president has that. Every president's administration has a right to that. However, at the same time, it is not acceptable to basically, you know, take the Constitution, ball it up, treat it like it's nothing more than something on a roll of Charmin, and then tell everybody, you know what, suck it up, live with it, because this is what I want to see happen. Every president has a vision for the country when they come in, and we respect the right of the majority to govern. What we don't, I think, respect and have
not
less
to
of
govern
an appetite.
Illegally.
Right, right. We have less of an appetite for the bedrock of things that have helped to shape the country to what it is. We've got a problem with that, not just being chiseled away or chipped away, but somebody rolling a stick of dynamite in and just deciding, you know, none of this is going to be in effect anymore. We're taking all of this away. And that therein, I think, lies a huge problem.
I think opponents of not just the DEI orders, but opponents of all of Trump's executive orders, especially the controversial ones, ought to take a page out of his playbook. I think it should be litigate, 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 delay, 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 appeal, appeal, appeal. And maybe with all of that, we're past the midterms and we have some change in the dynamic going on. You know, but just to sit by or to voluntarily comply or even comply without saying anything, you know, you might have to comply. But if you're complying, at least go down complaining about it, you know, saying how wrong it is for this to happen. But there is litigation on the DEI. It was filed February 3rd in federal court in Maryland. I think the plaintiffs are very interesting. Mm-hmm. The National Association of Diversity Officers in Higher Education, check, that makes sense. The American Association of University Professors, check, that makes sense. Even though the universities are gutless, at least the faculty unions are strong. Restaurant Opportunities Center United. That's an interesting plaintiff. I'm not sure what exactly that is. And the City of Baltimore Mayor and City Council talking about going down to the local areas.
I told you there's going to be state and local governments affected.
And what they basically are arguing is that the executive orders undermine efforts to correct historical discrimination against women, racial minorities, and LGBT individuals. They have four basic legal theories. I want to run these by you quickly. We've only got about a few minutes left, but one is that executive orders exceed Trump's constitutional authority, infringing on the spending power, which the Constitution grants exclusively to Congress by threatening economic sanctions for those who advocate equality and inclusion. Now, you were a former staffer on the Hill in Congress. What does that mean, that Trump exceeds his constitutional authority, infringing on the spending power of Congress?
And so essentially what happens here, so that people understand the process, is Congress, and this isn't even coming from my experience as a staffer on the Hill, but I thank you for that. You know, I am about to date myself when I tell you, I grew up on Schoolhouse Rocky. And, you know, Schoolhouse Rocky taught me about the three branches of government and the roles of these three branches of government. So if y'all ever, you know, remember that I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. That song is seared in my memory because that was probably one of my first introductions to government and how things work. And what we know and should know is that Congress retains that what we call the power of the purse strings. They are responsible for what's called an appropriation or budgeting or an allocation process. They are the ones that decide who, which department, which division gets what money, what for what program. And so that appropriation process is very laborious, it's intense, but it's also necessary. But once Congress appropriates or provides the money for certain programs or projects or agencies, then it is not within the authority of the executive branch, who, by the way, their job is to execute. So to take that budget, to ensure that it is dispersed and ensure that it is used in a manner that Congress intended. The executive branch cannot substitute its judgment for that of Congress, because remember at the top of this, we said we have three separate and co-equal branches of government. If you have an executive branch that can come in and just say, nope, I don't like what Congress did, I'm going to do this my way, then that's not equal, nor is it really separate. It is the executive being able to bully or overshadow or substitute his judgment for that of another branch of government. So it now makes Congress, you know, subservient to the executive branch. And that was never the intent of this democracy. And so when you said that the actions of the administration are essentially seeking to subvert the actions of the legislature, that is absolutely what the argument is, which is when Congress says this is how it allocates money, there is no ability of the executive branch to come in and to decide that, no, the money won't be allocated that way. No, it won't be spent that way. No, you won't give it to them that way. No, we will not support this particular program. That is not the duty of the executive branch. Again, although the executive branch does have powers, it does not have the power to undo the appropriation or the allocations that the legislative branch have done, unless, again, it's illegal. And that is then a question for the judicial branch to resolve, not a question for the executive branch to resolve.
Moving on, the second argument marries exactly with what you were saying, that the executive order violates the separation of powers enshrined in the Constitution. That's a variation on what you just said. The third argument, and this is interesting because it harkens back to what we were talking about earlier in this episode, and that is that the language of the executive order is unconstitutionally vague, meaning that it fails to provide a person with fair notice of what is prohibited in violation of the Fifth Amendment. Can you talk about that briefly?
Well, and again, so what we have here is there is a requirement that, and I think I said this before. Remember when I said I think these are, you know, very poorly written orders?
Yeah, you said they were vague, right?
They were, that they lack the specificity that's necessary to pass what we call constitutional muster. If the executive branch seeks to impose a rule, law, order, or anything that, you know, kind of bumps up against the Constitution and challenges the Constitution and its framework, then they have to satisfy certain tests. It has to be very specific. It has to be worded very carefully. It still may. It still may be subject to challenge, even if these hurdles had been met. But when you talk about something being unconstitutionally vague, what it means is essentially that it is triggered a challenge against the United States Constitution because the language of it is not clear or specific enough to alert all of us that it doesn't offend the Constitution. It could also be not just vague, but broad. And so as opposed to, you know, directing its attention to a specific issue, specific point, or specific concern, it could be so broad that it just sweeps everybody in and everything in, and it does so unfairly. And so if, in fact, you are going to create or issue something that challenges the Constitution, it has to be what we call narrowly tailored to satisfy a very specific purpose. And if it is not narrowly tailored or specifically written and very, very carefully crafted so that it is clear and understandable that it does not offend the Constitution, then you are absolutely inviting exactly what's happened here, which is litigation and challenges to it, because the gold standard in a democracy, in our democracy, is our Constitution. That is the gold standard. It has been interpreted many, 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 many times. And even through those interpretations, there are many times when the reason for litigating or challenging something under it is because of undue vagueness, or because it does not have the specificity that it needs to signal everybody that, hey, hey, even though we're bumping up really close to the Constitution, we're not crossing a line that it violates the Constitution, because we're not so broad. We're sweeping in, other things, people, projects, or whatever that would offend the Constitution. And we're so specific. So we're not so vague that you're scratching your head, or you're wondering, or you're trying to figure out exactly how does this apply, so that it does not, again, offend those who should not be intended to be offended by it. And that's okay. Only one hurdle. There's several others.
Hold on. Let's go to number four. Number four. And you've got 2 minutes on this one. It says that the action, the DEI executive order, violates the First Amendment free speech clause by creating a chilling effect on expression or participation in anything that might be related to DEI. First Amendment arguments are always ripe for controversy. What's your thought on this one?
Oh my gosh. Chilling effect is basically what you're doing is you're creating an environment where you will have people too afraid to exercise their free speech rights. And that they will not feel comfortable without there being perhaps retaliation or retribution for doing so, which is exactly the antithesis of the First Amendment of the United States Constitution.
Right. Boy, you did that on time. In fact, you got a little extra. The lawsuit.
It helps when you have a timer.
The lawsuit in Maryland is seeking a preliminary and permanent injunction. If they get a preliminary injunction, it probably will be, as the one on birthright citizenship, applied across the nation. So we'll be actively watching that litigation, because a lot of this DEI stuff, especially the stuff externally outside of government, will hinge on the interpretation of this case. So we've got a lot of executive orders to talk about, and we'll be doing that over the next few weeks. But until then, how do people find us, Judge Gale?
We invite you to check us out, first of all, on our home-sponsored platform of NPR. So check us out at NPR. But you can also find Next Witness, Please, on any platform where you find your favorite podcasts. And that includes Apple, Spotify, iHeart, or again, any place else where you find your favorite podcast. Just look for Next Witness, Please. There you will find Judge Tom and I continuing to espouse and uplift you and inform you about the latest and what's happening in this legal arena, because genuinely we believe you don't trust what you don't understand. And if we can improve your understanding, we also hope to improve your trust.
Also want to mention that we're on Amazon Music Podcasts, and we're free on Audible. So if you're an Audible aficionado, we're right there as well. If you have any questions or comments about our podcast, you can email them to me at Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. That's Hodson at ohio.edu. And if you have any topics you would like for us to cover in the future, please let us know, and we'll try to get to you as quickly as possible. Next Witness, Please, is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law and what's happening with our legal system. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.